Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark. I'm still at Lawless, and I'm now completing the family set by finally persuading Rob Ellis to join me on the book club. Good morning, Rob.
Morning there. Thanks for having me. I'm sorry it took so long for me to choose a book.
Well, as listeners will know, I've had your brother, Matt Ellis, on a few times. But here we are at Lawless. We finally persuaded you to come on. We start with your comics or 2000 AD origin story. And I'm wondering if it might be similar to your brother's, which I went back and listened to. What can you remember when you first started reading 2000 AD and the like?
I should have listened to his podcast. get our story straight. I remember there were copies of 2000 AD at school, I'd say, which I think were probably in the 400s. And I think I would have read the quality comics reprints of Judge Anderson.
Oh, right, okay.
Special impact on a young man. And then I think that in terms of actually following the stories, for me, Bad Company, Brett Ewing's artwork on Bad Company, which I think is about 500.
Right.
And I liked that war story with robots and sort of mutants and weird aliens. And I think we probably read it till 800, which is interesting because I would have read the story I'm going to talk about when it came out.
Which is in the 700s, isn't it? Yes.
It is, yeah. I think it's early 700s.
Yeah.
708 to 716, and then it carries on 724, 730, which is, I think it's 1990.
Right.
I'm going to talk about Junker.
Oh, great. Okay, we're straight to it. Yes.
Is that okay?
Also, yeah, no, that's good.
In terms of an origin story, I 2000, it does mean a lot to me. The mixture of artists, and it was definitely my way of seeing the bigger industry.
Right.
I wish I'd come into it a bit earlier, and I'd know about the Mick McMahons and the Bollands, because I think by the time I'm reading it, they were certainly looking at leaving what they had left.
Right.
But it does upset me when people say that I missed the golden period. Like most things in your life, you don't want to come in late to the party. You wish you'd been there when it was all great.
Right.
But for me, this is good. I think I don't want to be down on these the 700 issues. And it's an interesting time to look back, because I would have been 1990, so I would have been 16, 17 when this strip came out. And I think I know why I didn't like it then. I think maybe I do like it now.
Oh, right, okay.
I've changed, I think, a bit.
So one of the things that people don't usually say about the 1990s and 2000 AD is the Golden Age, which is sort of generally thought to be earlier, obviously. But we've done a few gems from the 1990s, and you've chosen one. You've mentioned it already.
Mm.
We're doing Junker.
Yes.
From, as you say, the early 700s, 1990 to 1991, by writer Michael Fleischer, art by John Ridgway, coloured by Tim Perkins, is it?
I think he's coloured most of it. I'm starting to think some of the pages were coloured by John Ridgway himself.
Right.
Because he signs a few pages, or he signs at least a nice double page spread. I can't tell, because I think 2000 AD, I looked it up earlier, so this is my own knowledge, but 723 was the first full colour prog.
Oh, okay.
Which is in the middle of this run. And I think, this might be wrong, but I think the Horned God changed the industry.
Or yes.
Changed 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Colour sells comics.
Yeah.
And
fully painted art sells comics, yeah.
And I know a lot of people say, oh, but the black and white stuff was the good stuff. But I kind of like the colour stuff. But not all the guys obviously could do it as well as Bisley.
Lettering by Tom Frame, but there's also a letterer credited called E. Fell, which sounds like it might be a pseudonym. I actually don't know.
Oh, no, I think L. E. Fell. Is that not?
Oh, right.
Is that not a established letter?
Oh, is that L. E. Fell? Okay.
That's what I assumed, but again, a little Google's quite dangerous.
Yeah, okay, all right. And I'm, as we say, Junker. It was reprinted in the well-named Quality Comics, wasn't it?
No, I think this is unfair, because this I have bought these comics. This is what interests me about this, that I've bought these comics three or four times
right.
to read again, and then probably just lost or binned again.
Right.
But I did buy these American-sized reprints.
Yes.
Because the strip's 96 pages long, which kind of fits into four, 24 page?
Yeah, something like that.
And the artwork doesn't look good shrunk down, I don't think. But the quality's all right. That's the weird thing. Except for the page sizes, this is when quality was quality, or Fleetway quality.
Right.
Was actually, they were quite nice comics.
So okay.
I'm not going to lump them in with the earlier reprints of things like Halo Jones, which were horrible.
Right. So, it's well, let me put it, say that Junker has not got the best reputation in 2008's catalogue.
Mm.
But you read it when it was coming out.
Yes.
And over time, you've come to appreciate it. Let's put it that way. Is that why you picked it for the book club?
I think sometimes I'm not very good in my head at thinking why you like something. But I've got into making my own hardcovers from comics. And I think this is the first time where I've printed out, I scanned in every page, retouched it a little bit, you know, made the whites white again, and formatted it and got it printed out and made into this hardback in front of me. And I think at a point you've got to think, why have I done this? And the truth is, because I enjoyed looking at the artwork close up,
right,
on Photoshop. And I think I might like it despite the story. But actually, sometimes a writer just needs to write a story the artist can just fly with, that plays to their strengths. I don't know if this does entirely, but let's get there.
Okay. Well, for anybody who doesn't know what Junker is, tell us a little bit about the story. Just sort of set the scene for us. What's it about?
There's a main character called Dennehy.
Yeah.
Who is he's a son of a gun. And he used to be a space cop or a harbour cop, as I think they change. And he works too hard. He's too good a cop. And his wife gets upset and leaves him, writes him even though it's in the future, she writes him a nice letter saying, I'm off. You know, you are a rubbish husband. And he tries to carry on, but he meets another woman in a space bar, and she causes him to abandon his post or whatever he should be doing. And his partner, sadly, gets killed. His partner's never actually shown living, so it's not that an emotional moment that it should be in the strip. And he then is reduced. I think the police guy who, when he's told you'll never pilot a spaceship again, except as a junker, which is a salvage operative. So you get a license to fly. You can go and look at wrecks, I think, and sort of strip them of any valuables and then sell it on at a salvage yard. So he's a space salvage yard guy, the lowest of the low,
mm.
I think, in terms of class, I think. So he's a sort of working class, but he's very angry, I think.
Right.
And he travels through space with he's got a little alien with him. Because he's basically Han Solo. Let's not mess about. He's Han Solo. He hasn't got Chewbacca. He's got a green alien that he calls Raz. There's a running joke. He calls him Razola, Razmataz, Ragamuffin. And it's a green lizard that's the size of a monkey that jumps around but can speak perfect English.
Right.
Who gives him something to talk to. And also is... At one point he all these spines burst out of him. He's almost like a sort of a bodyguard, I guess. Mm. But Junker, instead of being like Han Solo and Chewbacca, where you get the idea they're best friends, best buddies and respect each other, he doesn't seem to like this little green alien either. And I think in the first issue, calls him Animal.
Yes, refers to him as Animal quite a lot, doesn't he?
Which is odd, because he's a sentient creature. And even the creature, even Raz sort of goes Animal with a question mark. And there's a slight feeling of racism there in the character, which is... It's an odd feeling in an opener to a comic. Anyway, here's adventures, and they largely involve bumping into a space princess that he saves
from
being mugged, I think, outside a space bar. She has the plot device, which is a stone, which seems to be able to disrupt things. And I think you get the idea that it's all about this stone that's going to be used as a weapon of mass destruction, or to turn off a weapon of mass destruction. I think that's it. And it constantly interferes with his spaceship, causing it to malfunction, and they just have adventures.
Okay, so, as you say...
Sounds awful, doesn't it?
Well, it is very Han Solo, except... Because the other thing about Han Solo and Chewbacca is, as you say, you get the impression that they've been long friends, but also that basically, underneath their gruff exteriors, they're quite decent. Whereas Dennehy's a gruff exterior... I'm not quite sure I get the same roguish charm from him. He just seems quite a lot of the time to be just generally nasty to people, doesn't he? He's very bitter, let's put it that way.
I don't know if... I did a little bit of research about Michael Fleischer.
Yes.
I've had problems saying that name. And I asked someone, an American guy that I was in contact with, about him. And he said his Spectre run in the 70s was just outstanding.
Oh, right. Okay.
And he obviously came to 2000 AD and did a lot of Rogue Trooper.
Yeah.
And this American guy said, but the Rogue Trooper was dreadful. And I was interested how 2000 AD ended up with him, but giving him such long runs, because he did Harlem Heroes as well, which for me was another strip that just went on forever without kind of getting anywhere, but hidden with nice-ish artwork.
So Michael Fleischer, 1942 to 2018, sadly no longer with us. As you say, The Spectre, Jonah Hex, Batman. He wrote the dialogue with Steve Ditko for Shade the Changing Man, right, in 77, 78. As you say, he did a variety of work for 2000 AD, including this completely new strip he created for them. There's a variety of stories that I've read in the last week or so about Michael Fleischer, who, let's say, had a reputation for being slightly eccentric and possibly difficult to work with. I know John Ridgway, the artist, I think, I'm not sure it's in the article you sent me, but John Ridgway sort of infamously phoned him up but got the time difference to the States wrong, so he woke Michael Fleischer up, and their resulting conversation about what this strip was about was mainly Michael Fleischer shouting at him, apparently.
Well, can I read the quote out from John Ridgway, because it's always bad to paraphrase someone. This is from a magazine interview years later. Junker just went on and on without ever getting anywhere. The hero, or should I say anti-hero, spent all his time going from place to place, getting into scrapes, but for no real reason. To be honest, I'm still baffled by certain elements of the strip.
Right.
Which I think is lovely. And I'm looking at the strip now. My feelings probably towards John Ridgway are what make it for me. I've got a confusing... Part of me thinks, oh God, how did he end up doing 96 pages of quite detailed space work that don't add up to much, when he could have been doing other stuff, you know, or, you know, the offers for other stuff I can't believe weren't there. But maybe he always wanted to do a kind of a Dan Dare-esque thing.
Well, before I start asking you about John Ridgway's artwork, I've got the other anecdote, which is from David Bishop, who was like sub-editing this. And David Bishop in Thrill Power Overload says that he thought Junker initially was a tongue-in-cheek gag from Michael Fleischer. But as it went on, he felt that Michael Fleischer was actually quite serious about this, and that he wanted to tell the story of a space rogue who meets a space princess and has to rescue her, and there's a MacGuffin stone and a thing, and has got a weird alien monkey lizard as a co-pilot. Do you feel Michael Fleischer was really sort of committed to this story of space opera?
There's nothing in it that makes me believe that there was an end point to this story.
Right.
There's nothing introduced early on that later on pays off.
Right.
I don't think. I wonder if he... I'd like, you know, if someone said to me he had a messy divorce and this just got all that feelings, those feelings out, that would make sense. And I feel like... So this was 1990, but I think what got me thinking about this again was the Star Wars spin-off on TV called The Mandalorian.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
Which does a better version of going back to the original Star Wars film, as I'm going to call it, from 77. And you've got sandy planets, you've got strange marketplaces, exotic bars with robot barmen and brightly coloured... people and people are sort of humanoid shapes wearing masks and creeping around with strange little robots. And this all feels like he wanted to remake the first third of that Star Wars movie. But things had changed a lot, hadn't they? Like in terms of culture, I had to look this up, but 1990 was the year of Total Recall.
Oh, right.
And RoboCop 2. So maybe things had got a bit nastier, that the audience had grown up and they didn't want slightly sort of colonial tales of space being a little bit like Flash Gordon, I suppose, which was what Star Wars harks back to. But then when watching The Mandalorian, I realised that stuff can work still. Obviously, Star Wars has got tales of the Empire. It's got the backstory of the Empire or the Jedi Knights. And I sort of thought maybe this eventually, if I read it again, would have another level. It doesn't, does it?
It obviously has got... No, it obviously has got nods to Star Wars. There's nods to Aliens with the power loader as well at one point.
Yes.
Interesting, though, that the one thing that I thought about while I was reading it was Flash Gordon. That it felt like a very early 20th century space opera. You know, he gets into scrapes, there are space pirates, there's a sexy alien space princess, there's a twist, there's bad guys, there's an evil empire. Yeah, that's what I felt like. It was sort of quite Flash Gordon-y in that sort of aspect. And then, as you say, there is an ending, but it's quite an abrupt ending, isn't it? Just suddenly just sort of finishes. And you think, was that what they planned, or...?
I think sometimes you read something again, and I don't remember a comic where the space princess is revealed. Spoilers, yeah. Now, for anyone who's not read it in the last 30 years. The woman's a femme fatale. She's actually like the daughter of an awful tyrant, or yeah. her race is tyrants. And they enjoy taking over other planets. And Dennehy's offered to be like a pilot in this awful empire that we never really see. And he sort of turns it down, doesn't he? That's his character arc at the end is just to sort of say, even though me and the ragamuffin here ain't nothing more than a pair of glorified space garbage men, we'd both rather suck eggs than take marching orders from a bitch like you. And then he throws, he's got a gun at his head when he says this, and the Raz, the sort of the space lizard, takes a hand grenade off his belt and just throws it at the woman. And then John Ridgway's clever enough not to show body parts. Mm. I had to reread it to go, that's how the story ends, with someone throwing a hand grenade at a woman. And then at the end, they have a little laugh about a spaceship blowing up, and they'll be salvaged. We can make some money out of this.
Right.
And the tone's really quite strange.
Well, while you're talking about tone, the other thing that I noticed was the character, Dennehy, as you say, he's got this sort of slightly xenophobic attitude to his space monkey lizard, but also to other alien races. But also, because he's got the space princess with him for most of the strip, he's got a strange attitude about women as well, hasn't he?
Very.
You know, you mentioned bitch. He uses an interesting American word of frail.
Frail really does date it. Yes. It feels like something from the 1940s.
Yeah, it does, doesn't
it? I think maybe that's the weird bit of charm that gets through to me.
Right.
The word frail really did. And I put it on the cover, but he says this phrase, many a good man has been dumped in the piranha tank by a woman.
Yeah.
And he said it so often that his space monkey reptile repeats it back to him sometimes before he says it. But it's such an awful sort of, you know, if he just said, women are no good, or women are nothing but trouble. But it's not a quick phrase to say. It's so clunky, isn't it?
You know, now I'm fascinated that I'm wondering whether I should look into this and see if Michael Fleischer's personal life was, at this stage, complicated by divorce or otherwise, because was he working something out in this strip?
It does feel strange. I love some of the, because you said about Flash Gordon, but there's a touch of EastEnders in this, a touch of very small drama.
Right.
So when his wife, Dennehy's wife, there's three flashbacks, I think, which, to try and establish why the character's so messed up. And his wife, I think she's brushing her hair, there's something about sci-fi where you kind of have to, you should try and work hard to make it look like it's in the future. And she's brushing her hair, wearing a nightie. And she's just shouting, I hate you being a space cop. You're out every night. And then she throws the hairbrush at him, which is such a small little act. It seems like an EastEnders moment. You know, you can imagine right. It hitting a mirror and shattering or something. It's so tiny, this little moment. And then when Dennehy reads the letter that his wife's written, and it's almost left on the space Welsh dresser or something. He picks up, I think it's a bottle of booze. It could be a bottle of perfume. And he just smashes it on the floor in a big things, you know, big dramatic moment. But in terms of a space opera, that isn't a big moment.
Right.
And we've never seen him have fun with his wife. That's the sad thing. If we'd been introduced to his wife earlier on and she was a good laugh, and maybe he, you know, we're not shown whether he did work too hard. She's not a sympathetic character from the first time
we
meet her, and he's not either. That's the odd thing, is that there's no one that likable in this, except for the space monkey, who could clearly just find someone better to be with, because he's very capable.
Yes, Yeah, he's a very useful creature in a fight and in all sorts of situations, it seems. Yeah, okay.
I hadn't clocked the Flash Gordon thing, which is stupid now because I'm a big fan of that Flash Gordon movie.
Right.
I admit I've never read a Flash Gordon comic, and I think maybe I should now.
Right. We need to go back to... is it Alex Raymond? Or?
That's the name, I think. Yeah. Because there's how you treat sci-fi. Like in sci-fi, you've got to make some decisions. Like yeah. You've got spaceships. Is there gravity? You know, Star Wars just doesn't care, does yeah. it, about gravity. But it would care about an airlock or how you breathe. And this does... There's sort of mentions of that. But then using a hand grenade on a spaceship to me seems a little bit dodgy.
Yes, you think that's ill-advised, wouldn't yeah. you? Yes. Yeah.
And
they do use it a couple of times, don't they? Yeah.
And then people will shout about let's reverse the polarity projectors. And it's said, you know, it's said straight, isn't it? It's not played as a joke.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if Michael Fleischer would be familiar with John Pertwee, Doctor Who from the early 1970s, who was always reversing the polarity of things,
yes.
Technobabble. But yes, he does reverse the polarity at one point in order to disable the super weapon, doesn't he? Yeah. Okay.
I feel like we've stripped away the story now. I was kind of hoping to... I'm not trying to encourage people to read it for the story. I feel like we've done it a disservice now.
Well, why don't we turn to safer ground and talk about John Ridgway, who thankfully is still with us.
Yes.
Obviously best known to this podcast for The Dead Man and for Luke Kirby's Summer Magic, but also for his quite wonderful sort of horror work on the Hellblazer title for DC in Vertigo.
But this is the good thing. I did a little bit of research and I was reminded of a comic. Myself and my brother used to get a comic every week. And I think for quite a while it was Transformers.
Right.
Robots in disguise. You know, big robots that turn into cars and trucks and stuff. Yeah. And they were American reprints. It wouldn't have occurred to us that they were, but they were American reprints. But I don't think there was enough material, looking back, to fill the UK.
There wasn't, no.
So as a result, we got John Ridgway doing a strip called A Man of Iron.
Oh, okay.
And it was about a little boy who I think has a dream. He lives in a little nice little town that's got a castle nearby in the modern day. And he has a little dream. He's a dream about a giant figure walking through this. And it turns out that the story reveals that there is kind of a transformer. Transformers come from a robot planet called Cybertron, I think. And there was a rescue ship or something that was sent to help these ones, that the Autobots or whatever, that got away and got lost. And for some reason, it ends up buried under this castle. And it's come back. It's been reactivated by something, some MacGuffin, whatever. But John Ridgway draws it. And he draws the first two parts, then it's Steve Parkhouse. And this is January 1985, Man of Iron. And it's the cover just shows a transformer, I think, backlit, walking through a town. And you see the scale of the transformer. And it's everything John Ridgway is brilliant at: lighting, shadows, atmosphere. And the sense of wonder from the little boy seeing this proto-transformer, because obviously it doesn't need to transform into anything at this stage, walking around a castle. So it's a mashup of sort of robots, Arthurian legend, and British sort of countryside artwork. And he killed it. And the fact I remember that comic, that it came back to me. And it's probably why I love his stuff so much. And it, you know, he's... It's weird, because obviously the order you read someone's work in isn't often the order it came out.
Yeah.
So I'd mixed up. The first stuff I ever read actively after this, and I wouldn't have remembered that comic, is Hellblazer. Has Hellblazer been on your...
No, we've never actually done Hellblazer, no. And we haven't...
I feel like I'm going to scupper someone doing it.
Okay.
But let's scupper away. So January 88, Hellblazer comes out, and it's a character from Swamp Thing.
Yes.
A working-class magician, street sorcerer called John Constantine. And the catch is he often seems to save the world or England or America from a demonic possession or an evil sort of creature. But in doing so, he usually throws away his friends and seems okay about that or seems to make peace with that. And you don't want to be his friend. And he's a hard-drinking, hard-smoking man. And it's Vertigo. It was DC that became Vertigo. And it's I think it was the most successful Vertigo comic in that it had 300 issues.
Mm.
So unbroken run of 300 from January 88. But I'd read probably what most people are familiar with, which is Summer Magic in 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Before then, even though I think he did it after Hellblazer, but I could be wrong. It seems to be about the same kind of time. And Summer Magic sounds like you've covered it already.
No, I haven't got to it yet.
Oh, God, sorry.
No.
I think it's the best, one of the best things 2000 AD's ever done.
Mm.
And I think it's only six, seven, eight episodes of black and white artwork. I'm going to skip over it pretty quick now because someone else will do it. A boy sent to live with his mum, and sent away from his mum. His mum's ill. He goes to see his mysterious uncle in the countryside, and learns magic, and learns the price of magic. And in a way, it could be John Constantine's boyhood, if he didn't grow up in a council house in Liverpool.
Right.
But it's a kind of a middle class version of that story. Where there's always a price for your magic. You'll learn something. And it had sequels. John Ridgway did the art of the original. They did a couple of fill-ins, and then Steve Parkhouse did some. But John Ridgway came back for a big stretch on it. And it's lovely stuff. Again, it's that sense of wonder. He's brilliant at doing older people's faces, John Ridgway, and the way they stand. I can even imagine it now. There's a bit where they're playing bowls on a sort of a country green, and it looks real. And it didn't look like other stuff in 2000 AD. You know, I love Dread punching people and Road Tripper shooting people, but I don't think there's no real violence in there. So I wrote to 2000 AD when I was 15. And this is probably where this is my therapy session, why I want to redeem Junker. So I wrote to 2000 AD, but I think I must have put a list of names. I'd like to interview these people for my GCSE project. And I must have written... And two people got back to me. Pat Mills, who just asked for a list of questions and sent me a cassette tape, a 90, that he filled with the answer to every question.
Wow.
I wish I'd kept that. You know, stupidly, why didn't I keep that? But it made me always... I'd drawn a comic. That was it. I'd drawn a 12-page comic. And Pat was so nice about it. I sent him another one later and he said it wasn't as good. And then my comic dreams died.
Oh, dear.
But he was lovely, you know, but he was a gentleman. But the other guy, and it was John Ridgway, just rang me back. And I think we had two phones. So I think Matt or myself just hit a record on a little tape recorder next to the other phone. And I asked him questions. And what I like about him is that I said, and you know, I can feel my toes curling up now. So the 16-year-old me said, how did you design the character John Constantine? And he said, I didn't. He was from Swamp Thing. I'd never heard of Swamp Thing.
Right.
This is pre-internet.
Yeah.
Someone at school had sold me the first year of Hellblazer for a tenner. And I thought that was it. I thought that was the start of the character. I didn't realise this back history.
Right.
And he was so kind. He goes, no, a guy called Steve Bissett has already drawn him. I just made him my own. And there was a list of questions I had. And I didn't keep it. And I asked him, for some reason I knew he'd done Miracle Man. I think he did one episode of Miracle Man, a little side tale.
Mm.
And he was nice about that. Because I was like, oh, what was it like? You know, Alan Moore. I'd heard the name Alan Moore because of, you know, it was a big time for comics around this time. And he was so calm about it. But Hellblazer was why I really wanted to talk to him.
Right.
Hellblazer, I thought, it blew my mind when I read it. I probably thought it was cleverer than it was because I didn't know about Swamp Thing. I thought it was this creation. And he does the first... He only does 9 issues, which always weirds me out because in my head he did 2 years.
Right.
He does 9 issues, and I can't imagine how hard it is to work with that level of detail month in, month out.
Mm.
You know, 22 pages. I think it starts off with a double issue. And when I interviewed him, I asked him, and I think obviously looking back, he must have finished Hellblazer then. And I said, oh, what was it like, you know, doing Hellblazer? He goes, I didn't enjoy the graffiti over my artwork. And he didn't like the bad language.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I was shocked because I loved the bad language. And then I said, oh, there was a bit in a later issue where John has a nightmare. John Constantine has a nightmare, and he's in a theatre, I think with a woman, and it's a bit strange, it's a dream sequence, and they start kissing, and then he just starts pulling off strips of her skin, just starts dropping off, but it swaps to another artist.
Oh, right, okay.
One of my favourite artists, Brett Ewings.
Right.
He's not with us anymore, but he's a sort of a punchy graphic artist. You know, he's a fantastic guy. I'd love to talk about him sometime. Entirely unsuited to be cut into a John Ridgway comic. And so then you kind of get this almost cartoony John, sort of with this sort of half corpse woman. And I think there's a projection of a monster on the screen, which Brett could draw so many things, but he couldn't draw a scary monster. They always looked like a Brett scary monster.
Right.
And I had to say to him, well, what happened there? And he said, I don't know if you know about me, but I was a designer, like an industrial designer before I got into comics. I've designed hospital incinerators. I didn't want to see body parts. There's no need for that in the story. And I was so shocked because I was probably just watching, you know, videos like Hellraiser with people exploding into bloody chunks. And I assumed we're all on the same page. We love this stuff, don't we? You know, let's just Evil Dead to it. Let's just throw blood at the screen. And it was so amazing to hear a different viewpoint. And for him, he just said there was no need in that story. It was just a gory, cheap way of starting the comic off with a punch. And I respect him for saying that.
So, as we say, Summer Magic, Dead Man, Hellblazer.
Yes.
Even with the Dead Man, was sort of in a recognisable environment on Earth. Here we are in Junker. We take John Ridgway, or John Ridgway takes us, to space.
He does.
What do you make of the artwork that he does for Junker? The space stuff, the ships, the aliens,
I think he's really good with the ships. I think his space stuff... It's probably a little bit album covery and with the colours, but that could be Perkins doing the colours. I like the spaceships. Obviously, everything's coloured with an airbrush, it looks like, and paint. I quite like it. It's he's going for a sort of battered Star Wars look. I think he's less successful. The aliens all have a look like Star Wars, like they can only be sort of humanoid shapes. You know, you can't have an alien that's made of liquid or 10-foot tall or riding a beast. Everyone feels like people with masks on, which does ground it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it makes it feel like a tie-in to a TV series that we never saw. The bit there's a kind of a Viking guy turns up who's
part
of the Corsair, and he's got a green beard. And it's the one time where I find that character just feels like a throwback to something I'm really not interested in.
Right.
Space Vikings. I mean, there's nothing else in there to make me care about the Space Vikings.
Yeah, they suddenly turn up and we're not that interested, are we?
No, but I think there's a bit... I think it's the start of the second issue, is it? Where he has to... The first time he sees the princess. Page 9. Does that work for you?
Yep, got it.
And I think this is wonderful. I think it's because he's grounded it, isn't it? It's a sort of muddy back... We know it's a back alley.
Yeah.
And the aliens don't look sort of glowing in their colours. The colours are there. But later on in the strip, they'll kind of look glowing. And I wonder if he started off... Mind you, it says Perkins on there, so I'm probably being silly. This feels good. Like, the colours feel a little bit more muted.
Right.
I don't think the actual character of Dennehy's ever given anything interesting visually. He's almost like every man or any man.
Yes.
Or
the every thug.
Thug. Yeah, it's interesting because in the first issue, he puts a gun in the guy's mouth and demands more money from the salvage company. And the guy looks a bit like Phil Mitchell. You know, he looks like a sort of a...
Back to the EastEnders connection.
EastEnders guy, yeah. And in a strange way, I wish that was Dennehy. That would have been more interesting to sort of, you know, what would it be like with this bloke? Because Dennehy's just sort of traditionally all right looking. You know, in our world, he'd be good looking, but in a comic world, he's just sort of interesting with sort of sticky up hair.
Mm.
And weirdly, he has to have the word salvage written on his back throughout. And I wish it said Junker. I wish they'd just gone for the Junker thing.
Stick with the title.
Stick with the title. And in a strange way, be silly about it. And I think sex, sort of brightly coloured sex workers walk up to him and say hi, something like, hi, Junker Man, double your pleasure, Junker Man. It's got a slightly weird feel to that of him being okay with this. But then he says, right now I'm thirsty, come on, Raz, and sort of pulls his little pet away.
Heads to the space bar.
And then says,
the cantina.
Yeah, he heads to the cantina, which weirdly, I mean, in Star Wars, I thought the barman... Is the barman a bald guy in the first Star Wars film?
I can't remember. But, yeah.
The barman, weirdly, is wearing a T-shirt. I think that's what throws me.
Yeah.
He's clearly polishing a glass, which is a nice touch. But he's wearing a T-shirt and looks... You know, he's sort of got a bit of a bent nose. But I quite like that look. He doesn't look like anyone else. Because Junko, I don't think you could pick him out in a crowd.
No.
I think there's... Tharg did a collect all the cards kind of album. Tharg's database.
Mm.
And there's a page of all the kind of generic men. And I think Junker's in there.
Right.
As a card. And I remember having these. Recently I found a set of them. And I couldn't work out which one was Junker. Because they all just looked like men holding a gun. You know, without his little green monkey. What do you find in the artwork? Am I allowed to ask you questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I prefer John Ridgway's black and white stuff.
Yes.
I do like the Hellblazer, and you've made me wish now that I could go back. Well, I can go back and reread those early Hellblazer issues because I've got them. I'm quite interested to go and do that. I found some of the spaceships and the planet scenes, which should be quite impressive, that the colouring was a little bit sort of glowy in places and put me off slightly. I think this was an era... the early 90s, when colouring was in a sort of interim period where they weren't quite getting it right. Slightly better paper stock, but only slightly. But, you know, the colouring wasn't quite right. So some of that put me off. I do love John Ridgway. I think there are moments when his anatomy lets him down in certain figures and postures.
It's interesting because he's really good at facial expressions.
Yes, he is, isn't he? Yeah.
But you're right. There's a few bits. I think when we're introduced to the wife, initially I thought maybe there was something up with her face. It's an odd pose.
Mm.
The colouring's interesting because he's boringly coloured, isn't he? He wears beige or brown jumper. Yeah. But he's given the space princess. He's got blue skin with a pink cat suit and white hair. So you've already got these colours. In most of the panels, assuming it's coloured traditionally. But then they keep using reds, greens and oranges all together, which... Well, the thing is with Ridgway's art is he's shaded it. He's done the dark and light for the colourist, hasn't he? And which is why his black and white stuff really does work. And I find the early Hellblazers, the colouring... is full on. I think it's flat colours, I think, in that. I think it would have been. Which allows his shading to shine through. Whereas this gets all sort of airbrush glows over the top. I think that's what you're saying. But by the time the space pirates turn up, the colouring just goes absolutely bizarre. All the floors of spaceships are bright blue.
Yes.
They're bright blue, but they seem to have yellow cod pieces, green beards and red tops. And it's sort of too much.
Yeah.
But I wondered, is there a precedent for this kind of colouring in either Dan Dare or Flash Gordon, or was that quite modestly coloured?
I think, well, I seem to remember they were quite sort of, the colours were quite flat on that, and not a great deal of shading. I might be wrong on that. But yeah, it might harken back to those classic space comics, space adventures. I noticed the Space Princess's pink bodysuit at times... with whatever lighting she's in, occasionally it does look like she's not wearing any clothes at all. Which, of course, you know, for an alien space princess, we're all for from time to time. but it does look like that. And then his great facial expressions. I did notice on the pages, because you sent me the pages from the comic.
Yes.
And I did notice on some of them, of course, on the back page, you get a snippet of another story that was in the prog. So we do get a little bit of David Roach, Judge Anderson, Engram, I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
Which made me think, oh, yes, now there's black and white artwork. I'd quite like that. But that was just by the by. Junker and John Ridgway, as you say, perhaps excels in the facial expressions and the shading. Some of the bigger stuff I didn't think worked quite so well for me, I'm afraid. I did like the alien space monkey lizard, though.
maybe he'll get his own series.
Well, of course, Junker never got a second series. And it could have got, you know, it could have got another series. I don't know if this was one that the editors sort of thought, oh, we've paid for this, we better just...
Oh, you think he might be sat in a drawer for a while?
I just don't know. I wonder if it was sat in a drawer.
Oh, no, wait a sec, because it stops for a handful of issues, which makes me think there was a delay with the artwork, so clearly...
Oh, right, okay.
So that's... What's interesting is, I there's some assumptions you make about comics where I think I was looking for a cover for the book I was making to collect these, and I thought I'll use one of the covers of Junker, but there's only one.
There's only the one.
And the words the editor or the graphic designer has chosen are "blast from the past" with kind of an enthusiastic exclamation mark, which sells it as a retro story, doesn't it? Is that fair?
It does, because obviously the cover, which is Prague, what is it? 7:15, Junker, blast from the past. He's in his space cop uniform with the helmet.
Yes.
So it's slightly misleading in a way.
It
because
is, isn't it? Yeah.
This is a flashback sequence that they're talking about with this blast from the past. And you only ever see him in the space cop uniform in the flashback sequences.
Yes.
It's got nothing to do, in a way, with the sort of main thrust of the story, is it? It is a very nice cover. You know, it does. And I wonder why they didn't perhaps put that on the first prog that they did, 7:08. But obviously, you know, juggling covers is a thing as well, isn't it?
I looked at the, there's the 2000 database called Barney, isn't it?
Yes.
Whoever helpfully has put all that information in. So I looked up the first prog it was in, and it says reprints and everything else in there. Because I think Anderson Shambhala's going on, and that's, I mean, the number of reprints that's had.
Yeah.
So this hasn't not been reprinted, it's been actively unreprinted. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it has, yeah.
Because I think worse stuff, and I feel bad, I don't want, you don't want to say someone's done bad stuff, I think worse stuff than this has been reprinted, and certainly for the artwork. I did, I made a sort of a faux sticker on the cover, and it said never previously reprinted, but actually I had to change it to collected, so it's never, it has been reprinted as I worked out, and I'd had the comics, never previously collected. I'd love to meet John Ridgway and show this to him. I'm scared he might not want to think about it again.
Right.
But my love for his artwork is so genuine with Hellblazer, and for the help he gave me to become, well, I didn't become an artist, but I became a visual effects guy. And I think maybe if things had been different, I would have tried to go into comics and probably had a low to middling career, realising I wasn't that good.
Well, but it's delightful to hear a story again of 2000 AD creators being helpful and responsive to young fans and not being horrible.
Ridiculously nice.
Ridiculously nice.
Yeah, and I should thank John Ridgway and Pat Mills. I don't think John Ridgway actually ever mentioned the comic I'd sent him. It probably was just beneath his contempt. I'll always love Pat for reading it. That's the weird thing. Pat had read it. And it must have been terrible. And he must at that time have been sent so much utter rubbish in the post. So I don't think Rebellion's ever going to reprint this, are they?
I don't think so. I don't think it's very near the top of the list for a collection from Rebellion. There is one collected edition in the world, a single hardback volume, which you're flicking through in your hands now. So what you've done is you've scanned in all the pages.
Yes.
You've cleaned it all up and printed it on very nice glossy paper in a hardback collection. One of a kind. How long did that take you, all that?
Oh God, to retouch it just a handful of days.
Right.
I love, you know, I could do this stuff. I like retouching stuff. I'd love to have changed all the speech bubbles because it annoys me that the speech bubbles change font.
Yes.
Whatever you call it, that does bug me.
I noticed that the lettering changes in places.
Yeah,
yes.
And I love, you know, at its best, I love 2000 D lettering, Tom Frame stuff.
Yeah.
Really does look wonderful. So I printed it out, and I think there's probably one-stop shops you can do this. I feel bad because I feel like I will never give these files to anyone else, and in a strange way, I've destroyed all those 2000 ADs. So
to give me the pages.
In the universe, only one copy really exists again.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? The numbers of Junker have not increased. I don't know. Hibernia, if you want to reprint this, and I'll send you the files if they're good enough. But I send it, so I printed it all out, or got it printed out online, and then I checked it all, because what I've learned is if you can make a mistake, you know, if a mistake can happen, it will happen. But I checked it all, and then I send it off to a place in Leeds called Spink and Thackeray, and they bind books, they make books, and then they send you the dimensions of the cover, and then you send them a Photoshop file. And then it always takes longer than it feels it should. And then they send you a nice book that feels like a 2000 annual. Is that fair?
Like the classic, it looks annuals. Like an annual size. Nice cover of the cover again for 7:15. But you've done.
I've tried to texture it as if it's an old movie poster.
Graphic design on it.
And I'm pleased. I'm pleased with this one. And I think sometimes you have to look at why you do things, or the fact you have done it means something. And no one else was asking me to do this. And I think Matt, my brother, seemed quite, because I've done hundreds of these books, or at least over 100. And he seemed quite taken with this one, which surprised me, because he likes his Dan Dare, which I've never found a way into Dan Dare, despite liking the artwork. And he seemed quite taken with this, so I took that as meaning something.
Matt is quite keen on binding his old comics together into nice hardback collections. Here you've done some scanning and cleaning and retouching and printing, which is lovely, and produced a wonderful, as I say, one-of-a-kind volume just for you.
Mm.
Yeah.
You make it sound sad and pathetic.
No, I think it's fantastic. And it is in a sort of annual size format as well, which is lovely. Because we love a hardback annual, you know.
Well, I think anything that makes you read these things more is good, isn't it? And I buy single comics still each week, but I don't really take them out of the bags. I'm either getting them bound or buy a collection. I just... Those little plastic bags with the sellotape, I find it quite hard work.
It is hard work. So you've spent a lot of time with the artwork recently doing this.
Yes.
So we play the Grail Page game where we imagine that the artwork, the original artwork, is available and that we could afford it.
Yes.
I looked on Comic Art Fans and I can see lots of John Ridgway art, but I didn't see any Junker Pages. So if there were Junker Pages up for sale and we could afford them and buy them for you, what would be your Grail Pages from Junker?
There was only really one image that I looked at for the cover, and it's page 70. And it's I like this. The space princess is lit green.
Right.
And it's a moment of strange physics where to slow a ship down, they fire lasers at the planet. I don't think that physics would slow it. Wouldn't, it would just make holes in the planet.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's a very odd bit of science there. But my A-level physics makes me believe you just make a hole. It's not, you're not pointing a hose of water at them. But that was the only image I considered as another cover.
Right.
Where she, admittedly, she looks a little bit naked. But it wasn't that. It was a nice, clean image of her. And I was going to do something with sort of the little dots. When you blow up in it, a printed image, you get all the little dots. I was going to do something retro, yes.
Yeah.
Like that. And that I quite liked that. Or I suppose the first page I talked about of chapter 2.
Where he comes across the mugging.
Yeah.
But
in a strange way, I don't... This is going to sound rude now. No individual image seems iconic because he is actually a very good storyteller. So they shouldn't work. He doesn't do big splash pages. And I quite like that he serves the story. Also, he's a master of... the strange page layout. He does sort of break panels, have diagonals, and it flows pretty good. And I think he carried this onto Hellblazer. Actually, Hellblazer was before this. But I love his page layouts, and his scratchy. I love his scratchy artwork, and the line width is never consistent. It's always all over the place, and he doesn't do hard outlines. He is the king of shading.
Okay, so we'll give you page 70.
Thank you.
The space princess in green and the weird correcting inertia or momentum with firing your lasers. And then we'll also give you the splash page that starts episode 2 of him.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Coming across the mugging in the back alley.
Yeah.
And it's also got the alien space monkey lizard as well in that page, which is great. Raz.
Yes.
There's also the actual cover itself.
I don't want that.
You don't want that, so I'll take the cover.
Yeah, I don't actually like it.
Right.
I don't know why. It seems messy to me.
It also seems like it's from a different story, which I suppose his past as a space cop is a different story.
I feel like he's wearing lipstick as well. It seems an odd... That'd be a different angle to take with the strip.
I would say that in your hardback collection on glossy paper, it looks...
Have I pumped it up too much?
No, it looks great. Oh. I think it looks great. I think it makes it look much better than the original tatty paper.
I need to meet John Ridgway. So
okay.
If somehow this reaches him...
John, come to Lawless.
I'd happily make him a volume of this.
Rob will give you a volume of Junker.
And thank you for all the amazing comics. And I'm sorry that I liked the gore and the swear words and you didn't, but he was a gentleman on the phone.
Fantastic story. Obviously, it doesn't have a great reputation, Junker, as a lot of 90s, 2000 AD and 90s other comics doesn't have a great reputation. you obviously, I've discovered, have got a genuine affection for this. Mm. You really like this.
Yeah.
Mainly for the John Ridgway connection and the John Ridgway art, I think. Is that right?
I think it, yeah, I think it's the faces. It's his art definitely sells. And the fact the story is so uneven, bumpy and unexpected, for me, adds a little thing. I like to be surprised. You know, I liked Big Dave being in the prog. I like to not know what I'm going to get next. And I think this is amazing because it has no subtext. It has no other.
Hmm.
There's nothing else going on. And that continually surprised me in the strip.
Is there... I mean, obviously, we all talk about the big names in comics. The Watchmen, The Dark Knight Returns, The V Vendettas, yep. Mouse, and so on. But is there a joy in actually discovering this more obscure stuff?
Yeah, because I think... The first Batman comic I seriously read was Dark Knight Returns.
Right.
And that's wonderful. I found it a bit horrible. But then can you go back? You know, I tried to go back and read sort of the Neil Adams ones. And I just thought they were exposition and it's the same with the X-Men. You know, I've read the Chris Claremont ones, but I find them really hard work. And for some reason with this, I can go back and enjoy a simpler story. I think that's probably what you're getting at.
Mm.
This seemed to be a time maybe where 2000 E was heading in every direction at once.
Hmm.
And because obviously, like, the Anderson story Shambhala has got almost mystical religious overtones, hasn't it? And it's about a search for what happens when you lose your vocation. You know, you lose your point in life. What is Anderson if she's not a psychic cop? Why are you? And I suppose this is about a man losing his job and just being a bit shit.
Yes.
I don't think that is where it was going... what it was going for. But simpler pleasures, I think that's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, simpler pleasures of the obscure stuff, the stuff that was almost picked out of a bottom drawer and said, oh, we've got 12 weeks or whatever, we'll fill that.
Do you think if this had popped up in issue 300, it would be thought of more favourably? Do we just slag off the later comics because they're not the earlier ones?
Well, I think what I'm finding from this podcast is that we slag off a lot of the stuff from the 90s, but actually when you go back and look at it, there is merit in it and there is enjoyment to be had from them, not just the sort of perverse enjoyment of...
No, I don't like the sort of the mantra of everyone good had left.
Yeah.
I don't believe it. I just think maybe that you have a magic time where everything seems to be working. But everyone talks about this golden age where every issue you picked up, Alan Moore wrote, Dave Gibbons, Drew, and it was all good. But sometimes there were just stories that went on forever with sort of plates were spun. They were quite interesting. But in the collected editions, are they that good? Better in memory sometimes. The only thing I would say is this looks like the colouring, especially like someone's trying really hard. And maybe in a way the black and white comics don't look like they're trying quite so hard to, come on, look at me. You know, it seems a bit desperate, all the colours and stuff. But if this had just been retro, I was trying to think, Mark Miller did... a Flash Gordon throwback sort of comic. What would happen if...
Oh, yes. I read that. Style something or other.
Really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the name of it because, you know, I love, you know, Mark Miller's sort of output and what he's doing now each month. And I like that. And that sort of came from a different place of what would it be like if you saved the Earth and no one knew about it.
Yeah.
And came home and you tell the grandkids and everyone kind of quietly smiles at you.
Yes.
You know, and, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
You defeated Ming the Merciless of Mongo. You know, it didn't really happen, Grandad. But this is simple pleasures, isn't it? This is, and in a way, the Mandalorian's simple pleasures.
Oh, yeah. I think they've gone back to that with the Mandalorian, haven't they? Yes. Okay. So, as we say, Junker has not been collected. You could find the Quality Comics 4-issue reprint.
Four issues of that.
Yeah. Or tiny. You can find the progs and go back and read it.
Progs are dirt cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, or meet me at a con and I'll
meet Robert at a con and ask him to show you his hardback, which is lovely.
I'll get my junker out.
Yeah.
That's good.
Thanks very much. Well, it was fascinating. Great stuff to talk about. Just very quickly, obviously, we're at Lawless Convention. We're getting ready for Sunday morning, second day of the convention. We've talked about it on previous episodes. It's a fun convention. Great guests, great fans, great time.
Mm.
Have you been having a good time? Any highlights?
I have. Sometimes you find someone who you didn't realise was a British artist. Mike Perkins, I'm going to talk about.
Right.
Who I didn't realise probably was at 2000 AD around this time. I know. But he's done a three-part Batman series, I think called First Night. I'm scared if I've got that wrong now. And it's an oversized magazine size format where Batman is set in 1939, like the original comic,
right,
which I haven't read. And it's wonderful. And he's there. And that was my mission, was to get a sketch off him. And he did it. And it's, he's wonderful, man. And he did about a year and a half of Swamp Thing with Ram V.
Right.
A couple of years back. And I genuinely thought he was a brand new artist. I thought he was like some, you know, like some guy pops out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I saw him at Thought Bubble. And I chatted to him. And I hope he doesn't mind me saying, he's a middle-aged, handsome-looking guy and so friendly. And I thought, well, I kind of blew it. Maybe he had a list already of drawings he was doing. I loved his Swamp Thing. The artwork's stunning. And this Batman is wonderful. Batman, he's got ears that kind of stick out like horns.
Right.
As he said, a bit more like a bat. And Batman's a bit, maybe a bit new. He's new to his game. Hitler's on the rise sort of thing. In the background, these kind of newspaper reports the story starts with. And Batman looks new again, fresh again, but it's not the year one, it's not the Frank Miller update, it's genuinely a period piece. And Batman's even got these little purple gloves on. Apparently Batman, did he have purple gloves?
Mm.
I didn't know this. I thought it was some sort of Killing Joke tie-in where
right.
the Joker would pick up these gloves at some point and go, my gloves now, which is absolutely moronic and why I don't write comics. But I just wanted a sketch off him, which was good. And then you always want something for the future. You know, there's so much here of celebrating the past, which is great. And you want to get Brian Bolland to sign something.
Mm.
There's a wonderful talk on War Comics, which I just don't like War Comics, but Garth Ennis had a panel on War Comics with three artists. And it was just great to hear people so enthusiastic about War Comics. And I've enjoyed Garth Ennis's Ribbon Queen.
Oh, yes.
Sort of horror thing. And outstanding, just eight issues of people's skin peeling off. That takes me back to the Hellblazer days. And such a lovely guy. And God knows, you know, he's so wonderful. These guys come to a convention that's only a few hundred people.
Mm.
And you can see them. Great to see John Wagner signing copies of Bogeyman, sort of in its reprint. And the newer guys, like Pye Parr.
Yes.
With his petrol.
Petrol head.
Yeah. When I chatted to John Higgins, I watched a Hellblazer signed by him. And we were talking about colouring, because I like his colouring. I like his, you know, a man that uses colour beautifully, and I think was sort of initially a painter in his stuff, and has been a colorist and an artist. And he named Petrolhead as, you know, something that uses color in a fantastic way. And just to hear his enthusiasm three tables away from Pye Parr's artwork is just a wonderful thing. And it's good to catch up with people. I'm not a huge drinker. I know some people here are very good at drinking. I'm glad Eamon isn't either, actually. So I find the need to kind of disappear to avoid, because I can just have another Guinness, and it's so easily done. But I think it's an amazing convention. I mean, we have loads of good conventions in our country, and the organisers are so nice about it all. And sort of the 2000 thing is there. But it's not everything.
Yeah.
That's the thing. A lot of people go, oh, it's the Judge Dredd convention. And maybe it was, maybe it used to be, but British comics is so much more than that. And actually, that's a big point. There's an art display, isn't there?
Yes, there's the David Roach Best of British.
David Roach, who, you know, obviously in his own stead is an amazing artist. But here, this collection of art, and John Burns, there was a thing called John Burns Earther.
Mm.
And it just blew my mind. It was just lovely, lovely art. You know, and you suddenly just, it's nice to go forward with comics and look, read previews, but it's also nice to go backwards and see the things you've missed or were before your time, or like Junker, you just didn't have your eyes open to see it.
Right.
And see it with fresh eyes. And I'd like to go and chat to him today. So it's good.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's a great convention. And as we keep saying, this is the one where you can get to chat to these people.
Indeed, yeah.
So you're picking up a Mike Perkins sketch today? Or?
I did pick up one at the end of yesterday.
Oh, you picked it up already, right.
It blew my mind of Catwoman. Blank cover, and fantastic. You know, it's funny, you can't sort of be nice enough about people's artwork.
No.
And great to see someone at the top of their game.
Yeah.
You know, really at the top of his game.
Well, to mention all the mics, I picked up a Mike Collins sketch yesterday, and I'm picking up a Mike Dory sketch today. So
just the Collins, the mics.
The Collins, the convention of mics. But yeah, it's fantastic. Well done to Lawless. Well done to Sue Hadrill and her team.
Thank you, Sue.
It's great fun. Hopefully we'll see you again same time next year, where Rob and I might even be discussing Summer Magic. We could do Luke Kirby, maybe.
What's the remit of this? It has to be 2000 E related.
No, British comics, basically. Occasionally we go across the pond and do an American comic.
Because I buy my comics every week from Crunch Comics in Reading. So maybe I should plug. Talk about something new.
Okay.
That is a shameless plug, but I love my local comic shop in Reading. It's near the station if ever you're in Reading, down Harris Arcade. And maybe I should talk about something new, maybe at Thought Bubble.
Okay, we'll do that. Rob, it's been great. Sunday morning, we're about to get all prepped and I'll head off into the convention floor and have another great day. And then a very quiet Guinness this evening, maybe.
Cheers, Eamon.
Okay. And thank you to everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, find all of these links at megacitybookclub.com. We are on all the socials: Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, the 2000 AD forums, and a brand new social media platform launching this weekend called Alien Space Monkey Lizard. Green Alien Space Monkey Lizard, I think, to give it its full title. Or email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got a book. Come on the podcast and talk about some 90s gems, maybe. Still, nobody has picked Summer Magic, so. Anyway, until next time, from here at Lawless, it's goodbye from me and.
Goodbye.